Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is Tim Kelleher, an actor who has appeared in a number of well-known movies, including Independence Day, Inception, 7 Pounds, and The Negotiator, as well as appearing on several television shows such as CSI, NCIS, Law and Order, and, most recently, one of my favorite new shows, Almost Human, where he plays a malevolent bad guy who holds a critical secret that has not yet been revealed, much to my chagrin. For our more immediate purposes, though, Tim has written and produced a short video about the Nicene Creed called, appropriately, The Creed, What Christians Profess and Why It Ought to Matter. That was produced for First Things, the media outlet of the Institute on Religion and Public Life. That movie will be the central topic of today's discussion, though I am also hoping to chat a bit about the role and influence of religion in Hollywood, particularly with the movies Son of God and Noah making their way to theaters this month. And we will link to Tim's movie, The Creed, on our website, as well as having a few other interesting tidbits there, so please make sure you stop by and check us out. Tim, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hello, Tony. Thank you very, very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I have to tell our listeners how I came to find you. You were one of my many Facebook friends, and I think it was several months ago I was bragging on the television series Almost Human, which I sincerely love that show. It's an old Star Trek, where they have both mystery and adventures type of vibe going to it, but then it also addresses social contemporary issues mixed in there. So it's a really great thing. And as I'm typing that in there, somebody named Tim said, "Hey, did you like the bad guy in the first two episodes?" And I said, "Yeah, he was really good." He goes, "That was me." And I go, "No way. There's no way I can know one of them fancy movie stars with the cement ponds and all that kind of stuff." So it was pretty cool finding somebody who had who was on that show that I really love as one of my Facebook friends.
It's a small, creepy world after all.
It is. It is. But just between you and me, and I'm going to have all my listeners tune out now.
Okay.
Your character is holding this big secret that seems to be a linchpin in the whole thing. So could you just tell me what it is?
Okay, sure. You sure nobody else is listening?
I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Well, the answer is, Tony, you're breaking up. Can you hear me?
Well, okay, folks, we're back.
It's still out of my script, I guess.
Yeah, I guess for those of you who want to find out what it is, as well as me, you're going to have to tune into the show. I really do like that show, and your character is very interesting.
Well, we're going to hope that he comes back for a second season, but it's what they call on the bubble, so we're not sure.
Well, my listeners, get out there and tell the producers of Almost Human or the network to keep it on. Anyways, we have a lot to talk about today, including your video, The Creed, as well as how one's faith plays out in the entertainment industry. I want to start out, though, with a bit of your background, if you don't mind, so that we have some context as we move through our discussion today. You start off your video, The Creed, by citing 1 Peter 3:15 that essentially states, and I'm paraphrasing because of the different linguistic versions of the Bible that are out there, 1 Peter 3:15 says, "Be prepared to give a reason for your hope in Jesus Christ."
Right.
So let's do that, if you don't mind. As I understand it, you are a devout Catholic. Has that always been the case?
Well, I'm practicing until I get it right.
Okay, yeah, that's what my pastor says. He says you're a practicing Christian, but you need a lot more practice.
Yeah, I was raised in the Roman Catholic tradition, and about 1995 or so, I kind of moved toward the Eastern Church, and then was finally received into the Ukrainian Catholic Church.
Mm, okay. That is very interesting. And that is, do you have a deep religious background? Were your parents fairly religious? Were you raised in religious schools or anything?
Well, in fact, almost all my education was in Catholic schools. I went to Catholic grammar school, then high school, then college, then graduate school, all Catholic institutions. But to get back to your question about, the quote from the letter of Peter setting a tone, I guess I could make it relevant by just telling a story that goes way back to when I was like 22 years old. I was a Jesuit novice, and I was, out there to change the world and all that kind of business. And I was on an Amtrak train. I was reading a book. I was sitting next to a young guy who was older than I was, probably about maybe 10 years older, but still a young guy. And I'm reading this book, and then I kind of flipped the page, and my bookmark fell out onto the floor. And he reached down and he picked it up, and I forgot that it turned out to be a card with a picture of John Paul II on it, I believe. And he kind of looked at it like, huh? And looked at me and said, what's this? And so we had this conversation. And it turns out he was like a doctoral student in one of the hard sciences, I forget which one. And he was, very, I shouldn't say aggressively, but he was certainly not having religion. He certainly wasn't having anything to do with the Catholic faith. And, he was asking me all the, the hard questions. And it was a combination on my part of pride, really. I was trying to, be sophisticated because I was a Jesuit after all. And the fact of the matter was that I had what I would consider to be significant religious experiences. And that is, the personal experience of God's presence in my life strongly, the overwhelming sense of God's love. And yet I could not articulate that or argue it. And I just felt so ashamed when I finally got off that train that I had not given an account of why I believed. And I couldn't even be honest enough to admit that to him. So I did him no service, I did myself no service, and I think, learning a lot over the decades since, that a lot of people probably find themselves in that situation, especially in a culture like ours where, kind of the default position is really kind of a bullying one, really. It is pretty hostile toward faith, expressions of faith, especially if they're Christian, and particularly, I'd say, if they're Catholic.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. I come from an evangelical tradition, and you do get that sense of embarrassment that if it does come up, you want to almost apologize for it.
Yeah.
The default position is secularism and say, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to talk about my stuff. I'll just go hide
right
off in this corner.
Right. So, I come across a lot of people who seem to be cowed by that that prevailing, cultural bias against faith, which, by the way, I find to be, as I've learned more and more about it and I've really engaged people, it really isn't all that intimidating. You had David Bentley Hart on,
mm-hmm,
that lightweight. And, he's forgotten more theology and philosophy than I'll sadly ever learn, but he makes it pretty clear that, especially this wave of what they call the new atheists, they really have nothing of a real challenge to people of faith. But, the creed really does come from, the communal experience. It's not just the words on a page that keep people in line. Those words are the fruit of long suffering, in a lot of cases, experience. So I think in that sense, the creed really does help, people learn more about, the deep roots of their faith, and it also facilitates, in a way, a surprising way, I think, it also facilitates the ability for people to sort of enter into an encounter, a personal encounter, an experience of God, which is what it's all about.
And that comes across extremely well in the video, and saying what you just said, especially about that story on the train where you had that embarrassing moment. One of the nice things that you do in the video is you highlight just some regular people. There's communities of people reciting it together, but then you ask a few people that look like young college students or mm-hmm a young professional that says, well, this is what the creed says to me, and it helps me to express my faith. And that was really interesting because my own personal background, I was raised Roman Catholic, and I remember repeating the Nicene Creed, and we just kind of went through it. And, since I've moved on to evangelical circles, that's not something that is routinely recited. I think maybe one or two times we've gone through it in our services, but it's not something that's repeated. And so this is, for me, this is an interesting way to go revisit some of my history and some of the deeper history about the Creed in terms of that. Let me go ahead and ask you about this video. So you did this a couple years ago. You wrote, directed, and produced. It's a short documentary, I think about 25 minutes or so. And you did this for First Things, which is, and people know the print version or the website version of First Things. And I didn't know they had videos.
Right.
And they do. And one of them is yours. And how did you get involved in doing this video? What motivated you? Did they come to you? Did you go to them? How did this all come about?
Well, it goes way back. I had been a long-term reader of First Things, and it was one of my favorite things to read. I mean, it really has been almost unequaled in terms of its, you know, firepower and the kind of people that they get. Whether you agree with what's in the pages or you don't, it, you know, you still have to acknowledge that they find some of the most incredible people, not the least of which is, you know, David Hart and others, you know, from Pulp to, you know, on and on and on. So I was a big fan of theirs. And, you know, I had always written poetry, and I had never, ever sent a poem out. I said, what the heck? I had some time in my hand one day. I sent a couple of poems to First Things. And at the time, the poetry editor was Jody Bottom. And to my shock, he got back to me and said, I'd like this one particular poem. Would you mind if I published it? And I was like, are you kidding me? I'm going to be in the pages of First Things. So I camped out for like a week at the Barnes & Noble in Manhattan waiting for that issue to come out. And, of course, it was late. But anyway, it was, to me, it was a huge thrill. And that began a friendship between Jody and me, which over the years, you know, I began to contribute, you know, essays to the magazine. And then, you know, Jody was asked by Richard Newhouse to come to New York. Richard Newhouse was the founder, of course, of First Things, and a real heavyweight. And he was basically grooming Jody to take over for him. And when he died, Jody sort of became the editor of First Things. And I continued to write for them. And at one point, Jody said, you know, why don't we talk about some things, like, you know, like the next phase of what First Things is going to become. So we had long discussions about this, and we actually began to develop a pretty ambitious plan that included new media. And so Jody said, well, how would you like to be the new media editor for First Things? And I said, well, I'm not sure what it means, but that sounds great. I'd be on the masthead of First Things. I mean, it's unbelievable. So we discussed, you know, how should we start? We wanted, you know, we had this, like, long-term plan, and the idea was to start out very, very modestly. Let's try something and then build from it. So we kicked around a bunch of different ideas, and I said, you know, what do you think about the Creed? And he said, well, the Creed? You want to do a movie about the Creed? And I said, yeah, I mean, the more I think about it, and I had recently finished reading Luke Timothy Johnson's book on the Creed, which really sort of blew me away. So we basically decided on the Creed, and it went from a two-hour documentary to a 15-minute documentary. But once I was in the editing bay with my hero of an editor, who worked slavishly in his spare time for almost nothing, he turned to me at one point and said, listen, you know, I think that you should lobby them to go for, you know, a more conventionally broadcast length. So I said to Jody, what do you think of that? He said, okay, if you think you've got the material. I said, yo, yeah, we do. And as you may know, there was a huge change at First Things, and Jody left the magazine. Unfortunately, he left the magazine the weekend that we needed to do the final, you know, polish on the film and lock it and the whole thing. And so there was still money to be paid, and he was gone. So I panicked. I was like, what's going to happen? Because a lot of the projects, you know, were changed and some were dropped. And so I contacted the chairman of the board, who was Robert Wilkin, who, you know, actually appears in the film, and he said, well, you know, we'd have to, you know, I didn't know anything about this, really, so why don't you submit the film to the board, and we'll, you know, see if we want to go ahead and provide the additional funding. And I was like, oh my God, what if they don't like it? What if they think it's terrible?
Yeah, you spent all that time doing it.
Oh, it really was a one-man band, and it was not easy to do. But so I waited and waited and waited. I finally get the call, and I'm like shaking my boots, and he says, I think you did a real good job. We're very, very proud of this. So to me, coming from him and knowing who else was on the board, I was really sort of knocked over. So that's kind of the story. And since then, you know, there's been a reconsideration of first things, priorities, and I don't think they're, I know they're not really interested in this at this point, at least in going further into the new media realm of things.
But this one got through, and it's really neat that it did. And as I mentioned before, we'll point people back to this because it is it's a great video. It's short in terms of the amount of time that it takes to watch it, but it's also extremely deep in thinking through it. I've actually had to watch it a few times to really get all the different nuances out of it. One of the things that you do with this is that you bring in a range of guests to speak. That it ranges from Eastern Orthodox priests to biblical scholars to the director of the Special Olympics. And you even have a quantum physicist in there, Stephen Barr, who actually has appeared on this show in the past. And it's not the documentary that you typically see if we're going to go through the history of this step A, step B, step C, but it's rather a telling of each of these component parts of the creed and its history through the voices of these, roughly 10 to 12 different individuals mixed in with other people that you see, just everyday people saying this thing.
Right.
How did you end up picking the folks who would appear on this?
Well, like I said, originally, Jody wanted it to be like a feature-length documentary, like 2 hours, which would have required a huge budget that we didn't have, and would have taken a lot more time than it did. It took enough time as it was, but there were certain things that I wanted to treat, and I wanted to treat them from as many different angles as possible. I wanted to me, it was important to bring in. To address the philosophical implications of what we're talking about in the creed, the theological. I wanted some cultural dimension. I wanted to be examined by scientists. So I came up with a list of names for each of those sort of components. And Jody also, because he had, tremendous contact through First Things. And we went through a lot of people, and a lot of people we contacted were very interested in participating, but because of scheduling, those kind of things didn't work out. Like a guy, Consolmagno, for example, who is the head of the Vatican Observatory. I would have loved to have had him on. He's a really charismatic, engaging guy who's really capable of making science and religion work in a way that people get. And he was really interested in doing it, but he was in Rome, so it was things like that. We got as many people as we could, and a lot of them came as a result of the First Things name. When you call somebody up and say, I'm calling on behalf of First Things, it's amazing the effect that has.
Yeah, I can imagine. It definitely lends a lot of credibility to the project and the weight of those people that write for it, behind it. It's the case. It's very cool that you got Stephen Barr, though. You said you had a... you just loved working with him. What's his story?
Well, he's a real serious physicist and teaches at the University of Delaware. But he's also extremely well versed in theology and philosophy. And he's a genuinely gracious guy. For example, when I met with him and brought the camera and all that stuff there, he was really, really sick. Really sick. He had the flu, and he was due the next morning at like 6 a.m. to fly to China for a conference.
Oh my gosh!
And yet he couldn't have been nicer. In fact, he invited me to stay for dinner and all that kind of stuff. So you really can't tell by watching him in the film that he was really, really in bad shape. But he was just tremendous. And so we sat down, and there was a blackboard behind him, and I said, "Hey, do you mind maybe like writing some formulas on there and kind of be cool?" He said, "Well, like what?" I said, "Anything but E equals MC squared." So there he was, you know, a real trooper, and he did the whole thing, and I think he comes off really, really, really well in it. You know, one of the things I began to realize as he started to edit it was just how every person in the film, I mean, they're all, you know, really, really, in most cases, tops in their fields. Never comes across as just mere parroting. These people speak with passion and with joy and real conviction, and that is the fruit of long years of wrestling with these questions. And to me, that was coming across, and I was like, wow, this is really, I'm going to be lucked out here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one person that really stuck out in my mind was Timothy Shriver.
Oh, yeah.
Who is the CEO or president of Special Olympics.
Right.
Because that comes up on the screen. I don't know him by sight, or I don't know very much about him. He's the president of CEO of the Special Olympics. I go, wow, this is a guy who really took on a huge challenge to work with kids that are in just really difficult situations, and their families struggle with their situations and stuff. And you just could hear the outpouring of love that this guy had, and how his faith has influenced everything that he's done. It was probably the most touching guest throughout there. But there's a lot of those folks too.
Yeah, every time I watch that movie, when I get to him, the way he speaks, I really get choked up. And you know, people probably wouldn't know this, but when I met with him for that interview, it was the same time that his mother and his uncle Ted Kennedy, and his mother Eunice Shriver, they both died like within almost a month of each other. So this is a guy and their family that has known tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. And, you know, I had read about Tim over the years, you know, and I was aware that he, to my surprise, you know, you think of a guy like that, young, smart, with those connections, charismatic, good-looking, educated. This is a guy who could have done anything. You know, he could have gone to law school, he could be an ambassador, he could have run for office. But he chose to take time off and get a master's degree in theology at Catholic University. And he's also got a PhD from Yale. But he takes his faith extremely seriously. And as you say, it comes across. So, you know, I met him at the funeral, at the wake of a very close Jesuit friend of mine. I didn't know what he really looked like. I saw him sign the book, and I said, this guy looks sort of familiar. And then I heard him talking, and I realized he was saying, hi, my name's Tim. I told him, I said, are you by any chance Tim Shriver? He said, yeah, yes, I am. I said, I didn't know you knew Tom King, my friend. He said, oh, yeah. So we began talking, and I said, this is going to sound strange. So I posted him. I said, we're doing this documentary at First Things. Would you ever be interested in sitting down and talking to me? And he said, well, I got to be honest with you. First Things, you know, I have great respect for Richard Newhouse and his intellectual contribution to the church, but it really isn't my cup of politics or whatever. I said, listen, I get that. But this is not going to be, you know, ideological. This is about the creed. He said, well, I don't know. I think I'm going to have to pass. I said, okay, that's okay. I get a call 2 days later from him. He said, I don't know what you did to me, but I can't stop thinking about this. I want to do this.
Yeah.
And he, as you say, not only is he extremely articulate, but it is connected to something very, very deep and genuine, and it really shines through.
Yeah, it does. And it's just for that is worth the price of admission alone to see the video.
I agree with you.
But, you know, everybody else is astounding on here. I have one question before we dig into the movie, though, and this comes up right in the first 30 seconds or first minute of the video. On the box that the DVD comes in, it says a film by Tim Kelleher. But when you go into the opening credits, it says a consideration by Tim Kelleher. Why do you use the word consideration? That grabbed my attention right away.
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I guess in a way, I wanted the viewer to understand that, you know, I was considering this. I was coming to this as a filmmaker with questions myself, and I was considering the creed in the form of a, you know, a film project. And I guess that's pretty much what I meant.
Okay.
I mean, Spike Lee says, calls his movies, a joint by Spike Lee. So maybe my thing will be a consideration.
And it was nice because, again, as I mentioned earlier, the vibe that this documentary portrays is that this is not an academic discussion of the creed the way that you would get it in a college classroom where it says memorize these 12 points and then let's have a test on it. But it's really asking people about their impressions of it, the history of it, the linguistic aspects of it, the scientific aspects of it. And it was a video that I didn't quite expect. I expected more of the step-by-step video, but I watched it through the first time, and then it comes with a small trailer. And I didn't watch the trailer first, so I guess I'm kind of doing this backwards. But I watched the trailer then, and then I went back and watched it. I really kind of got what was going on. And just allowing, and this is why I loved it so much, is that it allows everyday scholars, people who live this thing through their lives, not only study it, but just live it, to really kind of speak what it was. So let's go ahead and dive through that. And let's start with the history of the Nicene Creed. You start with the beginning, talking about the First Council of Nicaea a little bit, and then how the creed gets into the linguistic point that we recognize it today, which is about a century between that the First Council of Nicaea and where we get the linguistic things today. How did you decide to start with that point? What were you learning through this process?
Well, first of all, when you sit down with people like John Baer, who is a major patristic scholar, he's the dean of St. Vladimir's Orthodox Seminary in New York, and Stephen Barr and Robert Louis Wilkin and people like that. I mean, you have to do your homework. I was really intimidated, and I was afraid. The first person I interviewed was John Baer, and I was quivering. I was like, this guy's going to go after one or two questions, are you an idiot or something?
He looks like such a nice guy, though. He's affable kind of...
He really is.
Yeah, roly-poly priest kind of guy.
He's a great guy.
Yeah.
I read as much as I could. He's pretty prolific himself. And then, a couple of books by Robert Wilkin, Stephen Barr, terrific book. So I was learning a lot just by reading those books. And then... another funny thing is, when we began to edit it, as you pointed out, it's not your typical sort of Bible video or religious documentary. I mean, I was really determined to avoid having to use a voiceover narrator or a host. I really wanted it to, if it could possibly be pulled off, I wanted it to feel like a conversation. And I think that, I think it works. And people have said so. But that was a real challenge, especially for my editor, who, again, I said is a saint. But I learned a lot about the creed through his reaction. He's a guy who, through the process of working on this, we would stay up till 3, 4 in the morning working. And he was just asking questions. And, he had not been in the church in decades. And... just watching how certain things would move him, and how interesting he found this, much to his surprise.
That's the editor you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, we would have these conversations, got very personal and very deep, and then emotional stuff came up, and that was a real eye opener for me. Yeah. But then, I come to the very first interview, sort of knowing a lot about the history of it and that sort of business.
And so what did you pull out of that? Because I will admit here, one of my own biases, when I take a look at the First Council of Nicaea, I see this is shortly after Constantine says, stop picking on the Christians. And so you had the Edict of Milan there. And I see it more as, let's quash out all these Gnostic heresies so that I, Constantine, the emperor, know who to send the paychecks to and fund it. So I have a much more cynical political view of the First Council of Nicaea, and being a political scientist, that's not surprising. But watching it, you give a different impression of here. So what, how do you view that first 100 years of the creed?
Well, it's no secret that, back in those days, theological issues could become like a gladiator sport among the Christians themselves. And there's no doubt that, I'm sure, in Constantine's mind, there was certainly a huge political dimension or advantage to having the Christians brought into the empire in a way that, as they sometimes refer to, added glue to the thing. But deep down, charges that it was an empirical imposition that the bishops, went along with is really missing the mark. Like I said, this is the fruit of real long experience of the original kerygma that the apostles received and passed on. And as John Baer says, despite a lot of the charges, this is not an attempt to curtail thinking. This is a way to ensure that thinking is free to engage these questions with real courage. Mm-hmm. And real independence. Like he says, it's called the canon, and a canon is a measure by which all other things can be measured. And if you don't have a criteria, then you really have no reference for whether it's straight, bent, or round or straight, or true or false.
And that really does come true, and that really helped to temper my more cynical interpretation of the creed. And so I really appreciate that. That's something that I've learned from this video and one of the big takeaways. Before we move ahead and talk a little bit about it more, some of our listeners might not all be that familiar with the creed. And given your own theological background and you said you're in the Ukrainian Catholic Church?
Right.
Okay. A lot of events happening in Ukraine right now. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, boy.
But that's for another podcast. But if you could, for our listeners, just go ahead and recite the creed as you would in any Sunday service.
Oh, okay. Well, I believe in one God, the Father, the Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, of all that is seen and unseen. I believe in one Lord Jesus Christ, the only Son of God, eternally begotten of the Father, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, one in being with the Father. Through him all things were made. For us and for our salvation he came down from heaven. By the power of the Holy Spirit, he was born of the Virgin Mary and became man. For our sake, he was crucified under Pontius Pilate. He suffered, died, was buried. On the third day, he rose again in fulfillment of the Scriptures. He ascended into heaven and is seated at the right hand of the Father. He will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead, and his kingdom will have no end. I believe in the Holy Spirit, the Lord, the giver of life, who proceeds from the Father. With the Father and the Son, he is worshipped and glorified. He has spoken through the prophets. I believe in one holy, Catholic, and apostolic church. I acknowledge one baptism for the forgiveness of sins. I look for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. Amen.
There's a lot of stuff going on in there.
There sure is.
And
that's the thing. It's like there is a deep, deep theological reason for this. And it really sort of can be boiled down to a statement made by St. Athanasius, which kind of sums up the whole incarnation. God became man so that mankind can become God. This is the whole point of the incarnation. If you don't get the person of Christ right, which is what the whole Arian controversy was about, then all of that is lost. And that's why the creed, it was so important for the creed to find a way of framing that that prevented you from making errors that would cause you to miss that incredible truth.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the areas that you do spend significant time in the video about, talking about the nature of Jesus, the nature of God, the Holy Trinity, so to speak. But I want to back up one thing, because when you recited this, I was listening very carefully, you recited it as I did when I was a Catholic way back in my youth. And you said things seen and unseen. But I noticed in the video that you used the term, and a number of people, when they recited it, said things visible and invisible. Was there Did you pick that up? I mean, I just, when I heard that, I said, oh, are they using different words now? I wonder why they're using different words. Did I use the wrong words when I was a kid or what, you know?
Well, actually, you know, it can vary according to what the church you're in, what the translation of liturgical texts are being used. For example, like in the Ukrainian church, there are different liturgical texts, sometimes from different epochy to eparchy. And so sometimes the translations will be a little bit different. It wasn't intentional.
Okay. It was just one of those things that I had been away from the creed. I hadn't recited the creed in my evangelical church very often. And so I said, well, maybe they updated things, or maybe I was doing it wrong. So I had to check.
Well, in the Roman Catholic Church now, they have made some adjustments to the wording of the creed. They have now added the word consubstantial.
Mm-hmm. Which I noticed. I went to the official Catholic site, I guess, and to see, and I noticed that word in there, and I said to myself, too, I'm glad they put that in there after I became an evangelical, because I don't know if I'd be able to pronounce it every Sunday. That'd be too dark.
More easy than homoousios.
Yeah. No, I know. Some of these words, I'm a pretty simple guy. So, but anyways, speaking of going through this and talking about things unseen or things visible and invisible, that brought up the discussion that you had with Stephen Barr, and you mentioned the background story with him. He's suffering the flu. You had him put a few equations up on the blackboard to make it look real scientific and stuff, which I was wondering too. I had to see that. I wonder if he's working on that right now, or if that's just kind of something that he threw up there to give it the sense that he's very scientific and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
What stuff did you pull out of that in terms of the creed, your understanding of the creed for that discussion of things seen and unseen?
Well, I mean, I think he does a terrific job of one of the things that I was concerned about, because, you know, a lot of the onslaught in secular culture seems to be, in a way, you can sort of reduce it to an epistemological question. I mean, how do you justify this, like, philosophically, intellectually? And what I like that he does very succinctly is he says, you know, scientists and people of faith are agreed on something very basic. We believe in reality, that there is a truth out there. And the scientist does the same kind of thing that a person of faith does. He asks a question, and he expects to get an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't know that because the answer is already in his hand. He has faith, and the faith that he has is in the intelligibility of reality, which I think is a great point. And it's a common ground that is often lost in these, you know, cultural wars about science versus religion. And he also talks about the deep structures, deep, you know, he uncovers as a particle physicist. And he says, you know, behind that is form. There is a real form to the universe. And behind that form is mind, which is a pretty intriguing thing, but I'm sure that, you know, other scientists might debate him on, but it's a pretty profound and provocative thing to say. But once you say it, it's not an easy thing to just dismiss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he does such a good job of doing that. And as I mentioned before, we had a discussion with him. One of my favorite podcast interviews was with him on the nature of quantum physics and religion. And so I'll point folks back to that to get a deeper and fuller aspect of it. But yeah, in the video, you do it very nicely too, as he's talking about the deep inner structure. The more you unpeel the layer of the onion, you're expecting to get to nothingness, but you actually find more structure and more intelligibility.
Mathematical structures and, you know,
yeah. And he connects that just so well to his faith in such a seamless way that it's pretty amazing. And I recommend folks, you know, just watch those segments of the video closely when you're doing that. The other issue comes up, and this is a big one. We're not going to cover all the points of the creed today due to time, and we'll turn people back to your video for that. But the nature of the Trinity, and this is a big aspect of, as you mentioned, historically why the Nicene Creed was presented and becomes an important aspect of here. What did you learn about the nature of the Trinity? Who really helped to bring that to the fore in your discussions with the folks involved in this film?
Well, John Baer is terrific, because he's so well versed in the patristic literature, you know, the fathers of the church, and they're all about that. You know, St. Basil, St. Gregory, Gregory of Nazianzus, all these people that may not be all that familiar to Western audiences, but they're the real pillars of you know, Trinitarian, of being able to articulate as best we can, I mean, let's face it, what this means, or what this suggests about the nature of God. And, you know, again, in preparing to talk to someone like John Baer, I found it really, really helpful to read the work of probably the greatest living Orthodox theologian, one of the greatest Christian theologians in the world right now, Metropolitan John Zouzoulas, a Greek Orthodox theologian, who writes a lot about these things. And if you haven't come across him, I really encourage you and anyone listening to pick up a copy of one of his books, Being in Communion, or The One and the Many, are two incredible books.
We'll link to those on our website so people can get back to them.
So that was really helpful.
And the nature of the Trinity is oftentimes very theologically difficult to understand, but what I found in this video was the importance of it. Mm-hmm. It's not so much the nature of it, but the importance of that whole concept. And what were the thoughts that came through here?
Well, a couple of things. You know, for one thing, you know, why do we talk about the Trinity? I mean, I guess in a way, we talk about it first because it's part of the way, you know, Christ talked about God, you know, baptized in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The Father and I are one. I am in the Father, the Father is in me. All these things are Trinitarian. Sometimes I used to wonder, you know, would that just be self-evident if you were just, you know, born alone in the world and had an experience of God? Would God appear to you Trinitarian? Well, I think you'd have to say no. And that's one of, you know, the really intriguing things about the Incarnation. Something also that really struck me reading Thomas Merton a while back, as you may know, Thomas Merton was deeply into Zen Buddhism and was described by B.T. Suzuki as the one Westerner who really, really did get what Buddhism was. And, you know, the whole sort of apex of the Zen experience is the Enlightenment experience. And Merton said that in the Zen Enlightenment experience, one can actually see a Trinitarian structure to it, which I thought was really intriguing. No one, to my knowledge, has really followed up on that insight. But the whole nature of this, what they call the perichoresis, you know, the interplay of Father, Son, and Spirit, and the outpouring into the world in incarnation, is just a fascinating concept. And, you know, like I said, the great Protestant theologian, philosopher Pannenberg, says that, you know, it's the incarnation that makes monotheism concrete.
Right. And that comes across very clear in this video.
Yeah.
And that's you know, the one thing that really it brought it home to me, because, you know, in many ways, too, our secular culture says, well, Jesus, yeah, he exists. He's a really great guy and, you know, said a lot of really cool things. But a lot of other people said really cool things, too. And
right.
So what's the big deal here? But it is that the incarnation and the Trinitarian nature and understanding of what the, you know, Holy Spirit is in general. It came across very well in this film. Let me move on to another aspect of it. This one was part of the film that also really resonated with me. I mean, it talked about talking about Timothy Shriver and some of the other aspects of it. But near the end of the second half of the film, you get down to the bottom part of the creed when you start talking about one holy and apostolic church.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really great because it gets to the subtitle of the film, mm-hmm. What Christians Profess and Why It Ought to Matter. And the film, it blends in different people worshiping in different ways. And That was really neat. What was the logic behind emphasizing the one holy and apostolic church, and what were you trying to get at and have other people express through their interviews in this?
Well, I mean, especially, the whole, like the Trinity itself, which is always in a process of self-giving, self-communicating. You know, Thomas Aquinas said that the nature of the good to communicate itself.
Mm-hmm.
The Trinity does that in such an outpouring that it becomes incarnational. The Church should be doing this, the very same thing. It shouldn't be like a fortress. The fathers of the Church used to refer to the Church as a hospital, a place where you come for healing, for building up, for exercising the capacity to, become God, basically. But a lot of times, especially in dogmatic arguments, there is this, us against them, and there's walls and drawbridges and people where they fire their guns and stuff. And that's, to me, just the wrong, totally missing the point. And like Luke Johnson says, unless we are communities of reconciliation and healing and building up of things, we're missing our vocation.
Mm-hmm.
Holy, Catholic, apostolic. Apostolic means, it's the same church from the very beginning, handed down from generation to generation, traditioned, which is what the creed is. It's traditioned from one generation to the next, starting with the apostles. It's holy. It's called to something special in love. And Catholic, meaning it's universal.
Right.
It's not exclusive. It's constantly reaching out and communicating in that love. And if we're not doing that, if we're fighting and pointing fingers, then we are betraying our vocation.
Mm. Now, that was a great moment in the film, too. And you feature a number of Catholic scholars, a number of Eastern Orthodox scholars, and as somebody from a Protestant background who doesn't say the Nicene Creed very often, I sat back and I said, now I really get a greater appreciation for this. It was an opening. And when you feature that part in the film, that this is one holy apostolic Catholic church and it comes across. This is passed down from generation, and we're all part of that. And that was a really emotional, wonderful part of the film for me.
Oh, great.
Say.
Like Robert Wilkins says, he had taken a seminar with Paul Tillich, and Paul Tillich had said, the most important part of the creed to him is the church.
Mm-hmm.
And Wilkins said, I think I agree with that. Luke Johnson says, Gregory of Nyssa said that the Old Testament revealed God the Father, the New Testament revealed Christ, and the church reveals the Holy Spirit.
Right. Yeah.
The body of Christ is carried forward in space and time.
The images that you have on screen at that time, too, of different people saying it, and somebody sitting on, looks like in front of a building, just saying, what does your faith mean to you? So, I don't know. Sometimes it's very difficult to figure out all this stuff, but I have the creed. And it really was as great, because it was normal, everyday people.
Yeah. And
right?
I think that woman, I think you're referring to the woman who looks into the camera, and she's very honest. She says, I have a hard time saying that I believe that Jesus is the Son of God.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people actually had that struggle.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's done very well. And I want to point people back to this. What was your big takeaway from this video? Did it change your mind on different things, that reaffirm different things? Did you find things that you never realized before?
Well, for one thing, I came to really appreciate something also that Luke Johnson says, which is that the creed is an underexamined, underappreciated, and underutilized instrument for all kinds of things, not the least of which is, Christian unity. That's one thing we all actually share. We don't share necessarily the same, ecclesiology. We interpret scriptures differently. But the creed is the creed, and all Christians sort of share it. And that's a great touchstone for unity. And again, underutilized in that regard. And he says, it created saints of incredible power. And we should really start making use of it. It is really a treasure. And I call it, a hidden treasure.
Yeah, and that definitely brings it out. I watched it, and I have so much greater appreciation for it nowadays than I did before I watched the video. So I thank you greatly for that.
Oh, yeah. So, so I guess what I'd say is, like, from now on, when I'm in church and we recite the creed, it has a much different meaning and a feeling as I'm saying it.
Yeah, it's not just the rote thing that you have to memorize at this point in the service and that, but it does, you know, hearing other people speak their interpretations and their how it has affected them has been very powerful. How has the reaction to the film been?
It's been very, very good. I've gotten letters and things from professors and church groups that have been using it to great effect. One professor said, he teaches a sort of an introductory course in dogmatics, and he says that, whenever they get to the part of the, Council of Nicaea and the Creed, he says, it's usually just numbing, kids fall asleep, they're bored. He said, but using this video has really helped.
Mm-hmm.
He said, it really has sparked a lot of really interesting, lively debates, conversations, interest, which is a great thing to hear.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I can kind of see it from the kids' point of view. It's like, oh, I recited this all the time, and do we have to do it again? I do it every Sunday. But now, it takes on more life, and it's I think a lot of people should take a look at this. And
another thing that really has been a very pleasant surprise for me is, a lot of my friends are either agnostic or self-described atheists.
Mm-hmm.
And, because they are my friends, I had to impose this on them.
Yeah. There you go.
they sit there watching it, and I have to say that some of them had the most gratifying reactions to me, because they go, this has really made me think about a couple of things.
Yeah.
I used to ridicule this kind of stuff, but this is, I'm going to think about this.
That's a very cool reaction.
It is very cool.
And speaking of those reactions, and you just broached this topic, and this is where I want to finish off our final minutes of discussion here, is your role in Hollywood. You're an actor in a lot of different movies and television, and your most recent character that I recognize is the role in Almost Human, where you play a pretty evil character.
Right.
And I've always been fascinated by this and how one's environment affects the way one thinks, and how one thinks affects how they react with their environment. Do you ever think about the roles you play in light of your faith, or do you just go through and, you're playing the really bad, evil guy, go ahead and just read the script. It does that ever come up, or is it just...
Oh, no, it certainly does. I mean, there have only been really two occasions where I had to really say no to something.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because they really were... to me, they had crossed the line.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't work enough to say, I don't need this. I've got plenty of offers. But, in both cases, it was kind of painful.
Mm-hmm.
But, I just had to do it. I play a lot of bad guys. Bad cops, crooked cops, gangsters, maniacs,
mm-hmm.
serial killers. I specialize in that, actually.
Yeah.
It's kind of a cliche, but they tend to be the more interesting characters to play.
Because
mm-hmm. you have to sort of find a way to, build the spine of who they are. And it's funny because people always say to me, how come you never play a good guy? It's rare, but I do. But, for example, I've gone in for numerous roles to play the part of a priest. Now, I've been in the seminary.
Mm-hmm.
Never get hired for that.
Yeah.
They tend to hire the guy with the rimless glasses and the angelic face.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you about that, too, since you play a lot of these bad guys. If I saw you walking down the street and, you stepped out in front of me, I said, oh, my gosh, that's that guy from Almost Human, and he's got the tattoo on the back of his neck. I'm sure that was just, inked on. It's not a permanent thing, I don't hope. But I would say, oh, man, I would approach you differently because I'm most familiar with you in terms of your movie roles. Does that affect how people interact with you?
Certainly not people who know me, but I remember being at a fundraiser in Hollywood once, and a woman actually came up to me and punched me in the shoulder. And I said, well, excuse me. She goes, you're not a nice person. I hate your character. I was on a TV series called Dark Skies where I played a real lunatic.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, excuse me, this is a Hollywood fundraiser. It's a TV show. It's fiction. She said, well, I don't like you anyway. Go sit down, Mom.
Yeah. No, that is funny. Do any of these roles in some ways get to you? I mean, on Dark Skies, you were on the Dark Skies for many, many episodes as a recurring role. And do you take that stuff home? Does it start to eat away at you and maybe chip away at some of your faith? Or do you?
No.
Okay. I've always kind of wondered about that because I see some of these, you know, Hollywood actors and actresses, sometimes they just almost take on the persona of some of their characters.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's, to me, that's kind of bordering on the neurotic. The way I was trained, we were taught that, you know, you extend yourself to meet the demands of the role as written. You don't personalize them. So you find imaginative ways to meet those demands.
Mm-hmm.
Some schools of method acting sort of make it, you know, truly autobiographical. You have to truly find ways to get really emotional, dark.
No, I was thinking in terms of that, Johnny Depp, when he does the pirate thing, he runs around like a pirate for a couple months before they start filming.
Right. Well, I mean, some of that stuff really does help.
Yeah.
When the camera's rolling, you can just throw it away and really improvise. But there is, you know, there are so many excesses, and I see you see them in the course of your travels. You know, people in the trail and extra making all kind of crazy noises. You know, vocal exercise. You're like, oh, really necessary.
Yeah. Let me also ask about your, you know, given that you're on the inside of this industry and you're walking around the sets and talking to different people, and as you mentioned, there's a number of not so religious people in this industry. And we had a discussion last year with Michael Medved,
mm-hmm.
who is a movie critic, and
right.
he's also a faithful, devout Orthodox Jew. And he has often been very critical of the way that Hollywood has portrayed religion. We oftentimes see the religious actors as the bad guys. Mm-hmm. You think of the that one Code movie with Tom Hanks. What's that?
Oh yeah, the Da Vinci Code.
The Da Vinci Code or something. It's kind of the characters that are that religious folks end up playing, and it's portrayed at. Yet on the other hand, you notice that when they do have films that do portray religion in a positive light or show the beneficial aspects of faith, such as the Passion of the Christ, which was a huge blockbuster, but also other ones like The Blind Side,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, nice. I loved it because it had football in it. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just a heartwarming story. But then there's also these other films that some small independent, you know, filmmakers are making, the Fireproof, Facing the Giants, those, they do really well at the box office. They make a lot of money. They draw people from the heartland of the United States. And yet we don't seem to see that many of them. We just came out of the Academy Awards the previous night, and, you know, none of these films or types of these films really kind of make it up mm-hmm. to the elite ranks of the golden statues, so to speak. And I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Why isn't Hollywood, you know, why does Hollywood do this? Are they doing it? Do you sense a change that's coming and people are waking up and saying, oh, you know, there's a market out there for this. People really respond to it.
Yeah, well, I have a lot of responses to that, I guess. For one thing, you know, when we say Hollywood, I'm not sure what we mean. Like, the Hollywood that we probably grew up thinking of is very different from what Hollywood is today. For example, you know, movies like It's a Wonderful Life or Midnight Cowboy, you know, you can think of dozens of examples,
mm-hmm.
are movies that would never be made today in studios. They just wouldn't get made. They're not formulaic enough. They don't cover the sort of demographic templates that marketers and researchers, you know, feed the studios with. So these really have become more and more corporate and profit-oriented. The fact that they don't really see the market out there sort of comes back to a phenomenon that maybe could be best summed up by something that Pauline Kael was supposed to have said. I think it was about Nixon when he was running.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe he won. Nobody I know voted for him.
Yeah.
The point is, it's very myopic.
Mm-hmm.
And those people tend to be cut off from, you know, what they call the flyover states and stuff. You don't really sense what's out there. I mean, who knew just how popular and how many millions of copies these Left Behind books sold?
Right.
They're completely off the radar.
But that seems interesting in light of what you just said, that you have all these marketing research firms directing, you know, filmmakers to this demographic or that demographic. It would just seem obvious that when The Passion of the Christ just, it did over $1 billion worth of business.
Right.
And you look at in The Blind Side, you know, people flock to this. Oh, this is just another sappy football movie. And
right.
You know, wow, did it do great? Or something like Fireproof, right, that they made on a shoestring budget.
And, mm-hmm. Yeah, but you've got to have, you know, in every studio structure, there is the whole developmental process.
Yeah.
So unless you have people in that process who understand the material, the way to find it, how to develop it, rewrite it, produce it, find the right people to attach to it, it's not going to happen. And so far, they don't really have enough of those people in those positions to do that, in my view. So that's a problem, too. There's also a sort of cynicism about religion, I think, and, you know, at the highest levels of decision making in Hollywood, it's too bad. I mean, in the old days, the old Hollywood, you'd see movies like Going My Way and Bells of St. Mary's, Angels with Dirty Faces, you know, all these kind of movies that are, you know, kind of classic. You don't see them today.
Yeah.
You know, and I've thought about this a lot, and this is really comes back to your first question about how The Creed got made at First Things. You know, Jody and I had a very, like I said, very ambitious idea, and this was to be the first step toward it. In my view, I don't think we can really depend on Hollywood to provide a kind of entertainment we're looking for. Which is not to say that I endorse, like, divorcing ourselves and, you know, creating our own system and not, you know, going to Hollywood movies or watching TV shows. But what I'd really like to see happen is, for example, Christians to work together to develop material, the kind of material that we're looking for, and develop projects and produce them and find innovative ways of delivering them to the audiences we know exist. I'm also not a fan of just any old, you know, Christian movie, so-called Christian. Like Flannery O'Connor took a very dim view of the so-called quote Catholic novel. No, her faith informed what she wrote, and I think, you know, if we develop really compelling projects, comedies that are truly funny, dramas that are truly compelling, but are sort of seen through the eyes of people of faith, not only will they, you know, reach our obvious constituents, but people outside of them will be interested in them. But we have to do that on our own. And I don't see why we can't.
Well, your movie, The Creed, is definitely a positive first step in that direction. And it's been a joy talking to you. My guest today has been Tim Kelleher, an actor and writer and producer extraordinaire. Thanks for being on the show, Tim.
Tony, thanks so very, very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.